tomography via plane integrals.
Thank you. So the work I want to report on is a joint work with a group at Philips Clinical Systems in Cleveland. So Daniel Gagnon and William Hawkins, and also Frank Wibbeling in the University of Münster. So I don't think I need to explain emission tomography to this audience, just my notation. Let's see where this stick is. As usual, we have here a cross-section through the human body with here a hot spot and here a detector array. And I have this little A here that indicates one of the detector positions. And what we want to recover is the activity density, and we also have to take into account, of course, the attenuation of the tissue. And so the detector output for a straight line like this, this straight line L here, is just the attenuated Radon transform, the two-dimensional attenuated Radon transform. So the Radon transform plus this exponential decaying factor. Okay, and as we all know, the mathematical problem is to determine F from the detector output, and in this talk I assume U to be known. The main difference between traditional SPECT and what we are doing at Philips Medical is that we do transmission by plane integrals. Now, we do not have collimators that single out straight lines. We have planes. I will show you in a minute how this is realized in practice. Again, we have this cross-section here, and now everything is embedded into a plane, and each plane we measure contains a crystal A. Okay. And so the detector output now is quite different. It's a plane integral. It's an integral over this plane P. And what we do, of course, is we average over all the lines going through this point A. And that gives, that gives rise to a plane integral, but to a weighted plane integral with a singularity here at this point A. Fortunately, this singularity is outside the support of F, of course, and so this integral does not really have a singularity, just look like this. And of course, we again have this attenuation factor, just the integral from a point X to this source point or crystal A. And we denote this transformed by S mu F by S mu, and we call S mu the attenuated solstice transform because the people at Philips gave to this machine the nice name solstice. Now, what does solstice look like? Here is a picture of solstice, and maybe I should, because it's really the main difference between traditional SPECT and solstice, I should just leave here. This is the solstice camera. As usual, we have a rotating two rotating cameras. Actually, we have two cameras for certain reasons. And the new thing here is the solstice camera here. Now I show you the solstice camera on the next slide. This is what the solstice camera looks like. Yeah. You see here, instead of linear collimators, we have slit collimators here. And here is the crystal. I always assumed that crystal is, this crystal is a point. In fact, of course, it's extended. And in this way, you see how these plane integrals are measured.
Each plane is
in principle, yes, but in the present implementation, there is a very small angle for certain reasons, people know who know Grangerat's formula. Okay, but okay, let's look at this machine. You see what happens is we have a dual motion. Of course, this thing here, the two cameras rotate, and the rotation angle here is what we call the spect angle. And we also have a tilt angle. This whole camera, this solstice camera, is rotating, as is indicated here, around this axis here. And we call these angles, this rotation angle, the tilt angles. Okay. And of course, we also have the usual linear variable S that measures the that characterizes the position of one of those two-dimensional detectors. Okay. So. Now, what the mathematically the main difference between reconstructing from plane integrals versus integral from reconstructing from line integrals? So, let's assume that the function we are reconstructing is in a certain Sobolev space. I chose H1/2, just like H1/2, and suppose we have data errors epsilon and for lines, and also the same data error epsilon for planes. All errors are errors in the L2 norm. And then it's well known that the reconstruction error that is caused by these identical errors in the data is epsilon to the power 1/2 in the line case, and it's epsilon to the power 1/3 in the plane case. And of course, this is much worse. And so the question is, why do we use plane integrals? Of course, the reason is it's not fair to compare these two errors, because planes measure many, many more events. And so the statistics of the data in the plane case is much, much better. And the question is now, does the better statistics of the plane integrals make up for this epsilon to the 1/3? Okay. And so what we had to do in the very beginning of the project, we had to compare noise in solstice and in classical 2D spect. Okay. And here is the result. Actually, that was a very lengthy computation, and a group of Philips and Larry Seng from Salt Lake City worked on this, and it took some time until our formulas converged, in the sense that we got out the same thing, that we agreed on the formula. But at the end, we all agreed that something like this might be correct. And the formula contains the quantum efficiency of the detectors. It contains the spatial resolution. And the spatial resolution was chosen in such a way, or I should say the number of detectors, the number of directions of tilt angles, spect angles, and so, they are chosen so as to make the resolution, the theoretical resolution of both machines, the solstice machine and classical 2D spect, identical. Okay? So, and then the resulting standard deviation in the reconstructed activity of solstice and spect satisfies the following relation. Here we have a factor that doesn't play a role. Here we have a factor which you would expect, of course. The quantum efficiencies of the spect detector and the solstice detector. And what is really interesting is this thing here. It contains the resolution we are aiming at over the diameter of the solstice crystal. And so that tells us if we make the crystal really big, then solstice becomes better. Of course, this is what we expect. And but this is also interesting that here we have the delta. That means if we really want to get a very good resolution, then eventually solstice will become superior. Okay, and this was a very encouraging result, and so we started working on reconstruction algorithms. Okay, so here are the assumptions I want to make for the reconstruction algorithms. Our data are simply numbers G, J, K, L, and these are the values of the solstice transform, the attenuated solstice transform of F at these angles. And the angles phi j here are exactly the spect angles, and these angles psi k are exactly the tilt angles. And these sl are the detector positions. Okay. I assume, of course this is not true in practice, I assume that the number of data in each dimension here is the same, it's always n, and we of course try to do the reconstruction on an n by n grid. Okay. And so the first obstacle was that, of course, that's quite obvious, the complexity of just the evaluation, applying the attenuated solstice transform to a function on this grid is n to the fifth. Of course, it's clear we have to evaluate n cubed integrals, n cubed plane integrals. And so our goal was to reduce this number to n to the power 4. Not only for just the application of the S mu to a certain function f, but to the whole reconstruction process. This would take us, in considering the number of n, which is a few hundred in this case, would bring us from hours to minutes, and this is what we need. Okay. Now comes transparency, which contains everything I will be talking about. Okay. We study four scenarios. The first one is we neglect attenuation. Of course, we know this is impossible. If we really want to do quantitative spect, then we have to take into account attenuation. But let's begin with the simplest case. And we make another assumption. We assume that the crystal is far away from the object, which is not the case either, because we want to move the solstice camera as close as possible to the okay. But just to make life easy. And then, of course, if you look at the solstice transform, here it is, then this thing here disappears, and this denominator can simply be approximated by 1 over a, length of a, and what remains is just the three-dimensional Radon transform. So in that case, we have the three-dimensional Radon transform, and the whole problem does not really exist, of course, because for the three-dimensional Radon transform, we have Mars two-stage algorithm that decomposes the three-dimensional Radon transform as a tensor product of two-dimensional Radon transforms, and so we get an operation count. If we do this, we get an operation count of n to the power of n to the fourth, and of course we could use fastback projection and so to reduce it even further to n cubed logarithm n. But that's the simplest case. So this is the state of the art 20 years ago, or even longer. In the second scenario, we still consider the unattenuated case, so mu is still zero, but now we move the solstice camera close to the reconstruction, to the object. Okay. And then, of course, this decomposition no longer applies. That's not true anymore. And we have to look for something else. And what we did is we developed what we called a fast solstice transform. And the fast solstice transform permits the application of the solstice, the mu is here missing because it's zero, this is just the solstice transform to n to the fourth. Okay, at this point, of course, the question is why don't we use just an OSEM algorithm at this point? Because we can evaluate this transform at n to the fourth operations. But this fast solstice transform really cannot be used for art or OSEM or something like this. It could be used for conjugate gradients, it could be used for Landweber and so on, but not for art and OSEM, simply because this is also a tensor processor. We can only compute the whole function, not just a few components of it. And with this far solstice transform available, we write the equation SF equal to G, which we want to solve, simply again by left multiplying it with the R3 inverse, with the three-dimensional inverse Radon transform. Now we know how to evaluate the three-dimensional inverse Radon transform. We can use Mars two-stage algorithm in n to the fourth operations. And so we simply use the three-dimensional inverse Radon transform as a preconditioner, and we can solve this system typically we do not more than two iterations. So, and we can use any iteration method. It doesn't really matter. The condition of this operator here is so favorable that whatever we do works. Okay. Now, the most interesting scenario is number three, as you will see. Here we assume, no longer assume that mu is equal to zero, but we still assume that A is far away from the support of F. Okay. And then what we did is we approximated the attenuated solstice transform by another transform simply in the following way. Suppose we have this situation here. Here our solstice camber with the crystal. And suppose then we have to, in the exponent, we have to use the integral along this line joining x with a. This is what we have to do. But in that case, we don't know how to evaluate our solstice transform. So we replace it by this solstice transform with a tilde. And this solstice transform with a tilde integrates not along this path, it integrates along this path here that is obtained by orthogonally projecting x onto the camera. This is an approximation, and we don't know how to avoid this approximation in the present state of our work. But having done this approximation, which of course is a very good approximation if the detector is far away, then it doesn't make any difference which of these paths we take, then again we have this nice factorization property. This approximated attenuated solstice transform decomposes exactly in the same way as in Mars algorithm, except that the second factor is now a two-dimensional attenuated Radon transform. And so since we have inverses for this, efficient inverses for this, and for this, actually that was exactly at the time when the Novikov formula came up, so that came in just in time. Actually, we should, in the light of yesterday's talk, we should call this inversion formula for the attenuated Radon transform Buchheim-Novikov formula. And so we can do exactly the same thing. We use the tensor product structure, except that now we have to make use of the Buchheim-Novikov inversion formula instead the usual Radon inversion formula. Okay, and the fourth scenario is now the general case in which we have non-vanishing attenuation and a near to the support of F, and then we can do exactly the same thing as we did in step number two, or in scenario number two. We just use this operator here, which we can evaluate in a n to the fourth operations as a preconditioner, and that's it. Okay, now I want to, maybe I should put this over here. I want now explain, not very detailed way, but with a little bit more detail, the single steps of this general procedure. And the first one is, what do I mean by the three-dimensional Radon transform is the tensor product of two-dimensional Radon transforms. Okay, here is the three-dimensional, of course this is ancient, this is 20 years, this is the algorithm that Bob Marr originally used for the MRI machine. this is the three-dimensional Wallen transform, and all we need to do is we define a function g phi for each spect angle phi. We define this transform, which is simply a Wallen transform, a two-dimensional Wallen transform in each x3 plane. Okay, and once we have defined defined this function, then we can express the three-dimensional Wallen transform just as another Wallen transform of this function here. This is again a two-dimensional Wallen transform. And so evaluating R3 is very, very easy. We just evaluate on each x3 level a two-dimensional Wallen transform, and then we can combine these two again by two-dimensional Wallen transforms, these two-dimensional Wallen transforms to generate the three-dimensional Wallen transform. And of course the same thing applies to inversion. I can use just the usual 2D algorithms for doing the inversion in this case. Okay, so that's nothing new, but now comes the fast solstice transform. How did we implement the fast solstice transform? Remember, this is a solstice transform without the mu, so in the unattenuated case, I have written down here again with this weight factor. Okay, if this weight factor were not present, then we could do the same trick as in the Radon case, but unfortunately the thing is here. And so what we do is we introduce a basis in the space theta perp. Will not be more explicit here, just an orthogonal basis, and then this integral just becomes this integral here. And again, if this denominator would be missing, we could play the old trick with Hofmeier's trick. Okay. And now what we do is we approximate this function here by a sum of products of functions. The first factor depends only on u. The second factor depends only on v. This is very easy. For m, we need only two terms here. So we can do this very, very accurately in the range in which we need it. And then if we plug this in here for this term here, then the solstice transform nicely factors. We only need to define a function g nu phi, or functions g nu phi. It's very analog, or almost the same, in the same way as in the Radon case, except that we now have this vector A of U minus R here, the A coming from here, or that should be an A nu here. Should have an index here. And then we can compute the full solstice transform simply by summing over these few terms here and integrating this function against the weight functions B nu of V. So the functions show up here. Now this can be done with very high precision, and so we have exactly the same situation as in the two-stage algorithm of Hofmeier. We just have essentially a tensor product structure, and this again leads to an algorithm that is of complexity n to the fourth. Okay, and now the last step. This factoring of the approximate attenuated solstice transform. As I said, we have again this tensor product structure, and explicitly it looks like this. This is just a definition of the attenuated Wallen transform with this notation here, with the divergent beam transform in the exponent. And then, very much in the same way as in the straight Radon case, we define this function g phi of x1, x3 as, now this is now a cumbersome notation, with an index here, fx3. I mean just a two-dimensional function that is generated by freezing the last component of f to x3. And the same thing happens here, mu x3 It's just the function, the last argument. These are three-dimensional functions in this case, of course. The last argument is just replaced by x3. Okay, and then we have just the usual two-dimensional attenuated Radon transform here. And if we define this, then the approximate attenuated solstice transform is simply the two-dimensional Radon transform, and now just the ordinary two-dimensional Radon transform without any attenuation of this function g phi. Okay, so we can apply the approximate attenuated solstice transform in n to the fourth operation, and we also can invert it using the Buchheim-Novikov algorithm for the inversion of this transform here. Actually, one of the problems of the Buchheim-Novikov formula is that it needs 360-degree data. And people in industry are not willing to scan all the way around the patient just to please the mathematicians. And but in this case, as I showed you, the solstice camera has two detector heads, and so we automatically measure through 360 degrees. And so it's, to my knowledge, the first real application, real-world application of the Buchheim-Novikov inversion formula. Okay. Now let's see what we can achieve with all these techniques. Of course, we start with simulations. And so you see these very simple phantoms. We're not very ambitious. What you see here is just a ball here that contains smaller balls with different activities. This is just mu equal to zero. We are in the unattenuated case here. I just want to show the influence of this weighting factor. Okay. And what you see here is the original. And what you see here is the reconstruction just with Marr's algorithm. Just with the Bob Marr algorithm, the two-stage algorithm that is 25 years old now. And here, maybe we better look. And down here, you see the reconstructions with the algorithm that uses Marr's algorithm as preconditioner. So our algorithm for the case in which A, which the solstice camera is close with the reconstruction region. Okay, as everybody knows, you can do everything with nice pictures, but if you use cross sections, then it becomes much clearer what you did. And I show you here the cross sections of the reconstructions. Oh, I hope one can see the colors. From here, I can't. Okay. So the red line here is the original, just one of the cross sections through the pictures you have just seen. And this line here is the reconstruction computed by Marr's algorithm. So you see the difference between the Marr's algorithm and the object is quite visible. And you can't do quantitative imaging with this algorithm. Actually, this is exactly the situation of the solstice camera. Of course, the Marr algorithm works perfectly well if the solstice camera is far away. But here we use exactly the situation in the solstice camera. In the solstice camera, the reconstruction region has a radius of 15 centimeter, and the distance of the solstice camera to the origin is 17 centimeters. So it's really very close. And what you can see here, the green line, this is the result of our algorithm using the preconditioning. And you see it's an almost perfect agreement with the object. This has, you see this discretization errors here, that's a very rough discretization. So, okay, so we see that without attenuation, the algorithm that uses the fast solstice transform in combination with the Mars algorithm as preconditioner works perfectly well. Now comes the problem with attenuation. Okay, we again generated a phantom that you can see here. It's supposed to be a thorax, of course, and it's three-dimensional. We have a cross-section here through the center of it. This thing here, this high, this area of high activity is a ball of radius of 5 centimeter. Yeah, 5 centimeter. And you see here the original, this line here. And here you see the reconstruction. And you see that the reconstruction is not perfect. Now, it's not perfect because, as I said, we did this approximation. We approximated the solstice transform as mu by this approximated solstice transform as mu tilde that puts the crystal at the wrong point. But this is all we can do so far. And you see, the reconstruction is not too bad. So it really recovers this high activity area, not with the correct value, but it's certainly much, much, much better than doing a reconstruction without without attenuation correction. And we have here a cross-section here, 4 centimeters away from the central plane. And this is even better. And if we are outside the activity area, we have no problems at all. Okay, so far, this is simulation. And now comes a big step. The big step is going to real data, as everybody knows. And what we can achieve with real data is you can see on this image here. I have been warned by people from medical imaging that I should say that this is not the best picture they can achieve. The reason why the resolution in these pictures is very poor is simply that they do so many corrections to their data, it's almost impossible to follow. So, what we simply assumed that the data they give us are raw data without any corrections for half a dozen of effects, and we did the reconstructions on these data, and so the resolution is not what we can achieve. But for the attenuation correction, it shouldn't make any difference. So, okay, now here you see a typical picture here of a reconstruction without attenuation correction. It's a typical dip here. And here you see the reconstruction visage much, much, much better as far as attenuation correction is concerned for with the algorithm that makes use of the approximate attenuated solstice transform and the Buchheim-Novikov algorithm for the inversion. Okay.
Excuse me, what is the object that's being scanned?
The object, I think this is one of the Jerzyk phantoms. It's one of the Jerzyk phantoms. It's just one of the standard phantoms they use. I don't really know. One other reason why this is very poor is that we just assumed a constant attenuation here. Of course, obviously, the attenuation is constant here, but at least it shows that Novikov's algorithm produces reasonable results. The present state, of course, what we really have to do, we have to work on the attenuation correction, and the next step is, as at Philips Medical System, that this solstice concept is combined with a CT scanner, of course. And, then I'm sure we will produce much better pictures with our algorithm. This is all I have to say. Being the last speaker, I want to thank the organizers for this wonderful conference. I have now been working for more than 30 years in the mathematics of medical imaging, and when I started out in the early 70s, I have made this joke very often. I thought it's something nice for the summer, yeah? And but I see now that this still is obviously the field is still very, very lively, and I think we all have fun, and I think there's a lot of useful work, and especially on this conference I have seen so many new ideas. I'm convinced we will go on forever. Thank you very much. Oh, actually, this is something we tried, you know. For this transform, it's easy.
Yeah.
But for the full solstice transform, I didn't even try.
What was the basis that you used when you expanded 1 over the square root of u squared plus v squared? What were the product? What kind of function?
Let's see. I think polynomials, but I'm not quite sure. Not quite sure. Yeah. Frank Wibbling would know, so he did this. So, but it's very simple. You know, you can also the computing these things is very simple. You just use IMSL routines and things.
Thank all of you very much for coming and making this, I think, a really